I'm Daniel Atlin. Welcome to Messy, where I have conversations with leaders about how they navigate and make sense of the mess they find themselves in. I'm very excited to introduce you to our next Messy guest. Sheldon Levy is a higher education leader and visionary with a passion for innovation, entrepreneurship, and the digital economy. Sheldon Levy was one of the first people that I reached out to when I joined the university system about 20 years ago, because he had had a similar post as I did a decade before. And despite having lots of demands as president of Ryerson University, Sheldon was generous with his time and wisdom as we had a great discussion over lunch. And I'm very excited about this conversation because Sheldon has had a lot of experience at many complex social purpose organizations, and he definitely has a unique view, both on the dance floor and the balcony, of the mess of leadership. Welcome to Messy, Sheldon.
Thanks very much, and a great opportunity. Appreciate it.
I'd like to start by actually asking you a little bit about your origin story. What drew you to social purpose-oriented complex organizations? Tell me a little bit about your lived experience. As Kierkegaard says, lives can only be understood looking backwards, but they have to be lived forward.
Well, it's absolutely true. Everything was a bit of serendipity. My background was mathematics and statistics, and I had a job offer right out of university to go to Ottawa in Stats Canada. I ended up as a summer student in the dean's office at York University. And this is right at the beginning of computing, but very early on. And I saw they were doing the budget on Selectric typewriters. And I commented that this was not the way to do it. You should use these new thing called computers, pre-Excel spreadsheets by decades. The dean at the time said, okay, do it. You could never get that offer today. And then one thing led to the other. And then I was there and they said, how would you like to stay? And so I ended up as an employee of York University. And they said, well, we can't pay you what Stats Canada pays unless you teach in the mathematics department as well, and then you could earn your $8,000 salary. It was serendipity, and then from there, it was just different opportunities that became available. Moved from there to being president to Sheridan. From Sheridan, moved to U of T as the vice president. Spent a year at Ontario Tech, went to Ryerson for 10 years, deputy minister, private university in Vancouver. But it all started never with a plan, let me put it that way.
Absolutely. It's great that we can make sense of these things sometimes. And your parents were from Toronto, and they were not really higher education sort of based, were they?
Oh, my parents, we grew up, I would say, middle class, lower middle class, somewhere around there. And they never went to university. And I think my older sister was the first and I was the second. But they, especially my mother, understood the value of education for sure. My father, I comment often, was a truck driver. He never earned a salary of $10,000, and he never was represented by a union and worked in a difficult and hazardous workplace that eventually had an effect on his health. So, you know, I became sympathetic to the why unions are important, while at the same time I saw the difficulties as well of unions from a management point of view, but I've seen the importance of them as well.
And I guess you also saw the importance of a higher education as lifting you up.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I would say there is no way I would have ended up with such an interesting life without post-secondary education.
Now, I'd like you to describe to me the nature of universities and just how different they are than traditional for-profit organizations. I know you've had experience at both private and public universities, and maybe talk a little bit about that. But I'd just love to hear just, you know, about how you find that environment.
When you grow up in a university, and that's especially a public university or a college, and that's your life, you begin to think that where you are is the way things are and they're normal. But when you go into the private sector, you find it is anything but typical or normal. The uniqueness of it goes to its fundamental governance structure, under which, by law, the public universities are bicameral, and therefore, what you could say is that 50% or some of the business is managed by the employees, called faculty members, and in a senate, and they control what might be called the products, the courses, the evaluation, who takes it, not the students' admission, etc. And then the fiscal issues are about the board of directors or the board of governors. But a president has a very, very difficult job of making sure these are in harmony. So just put yourself in a position of private sector. You want to open up a new product line, and your employees say, no, we're not going to do that. In fact, we want to maintain the product line that no one is buying. It's not that extreme, but it's not far from that. And therefore, when you have people criticizing the universities, their inability to move, their inability to adjust to the economy, etc., the truth of it is, look at the governance structure and ask yourself, how does leadership actually adjust in time when the laws establish this bicameral nature? The other difficulty people don't want to talk about very often is that there is, in my view, a conflict between the role of the Senate, which is the governing body, and the role of their representatives in the union. You have people sitting on Senates that are at the same time union members, and union members have a particular important role, but it conflicts with the role, or it could conflict with the role of a senator. And there's been a lot of jurisprudence on this, a lot of debate on this, but it's never been sorted out. And it's very difficult to talk about it, because if you're a sitting president and you feel like finishing your first term, or even pretend that you'll have a second term, you begin to go in those directions. It becomes very, very difficult. And the other big difference is that in many institutions, the choice of the president or the choice of the vice president academic has a lot of input by the employees. And for sure, you can't have your board of directors just fly in quotes, a president. President is, and the vice president academic in particular, are seen as colleagues. And then at the end of their term, many of them return back to the colleagues, their colleagues. So just try to compare that with the private sector, where you would never have the president of the corporation being chosen by the employees, maybe in some rare circumstances. And universities collect a lot of KPIs. And probably too many, but do they really shape the performance of the institution? Do they really shape the compensation agreements? Are there penalties and rewards, that type of thing? And my experience has been not.
Interesting. I've heard that people talk about the challenges of change in universities and other complex institutions. And I've got this quote, and I think I shared it with you when we had a coffee, that my favorite quote is that it's easier to change the course of history than it is to change a history course. And it may be a little bit of an exaggeration again, but I think that just highlights again the stakes that are at play, you know, within universities, and how they can sometimes be very different than a private sector or organization.
There's a lot of good reasons why things are hard to change, because too often changes are made by the flavor of the day, misreading trends. Just look at education in Ontario. not long ago, there was too many teachers. So let's make teacher education 2 years. You go down another decade and there's not enough teachers. Let's make it 1 year. There is a real value in stability, but stability shouldn't be defined as in cement or not moving at all. But I think the bigger challenge of it is what I would call one size fits all. My experience has been that universities all, understandably, are interested in improving their brand or the value proposition that they give to students. You graduate from my institution, you have a degree from my institution, that degree has value, and you as an alumni want to see that institution continue to improve its brand because your degree continues to improve in value as the institution's brand improves. But the brand of institutions, whether they're the QS ranking or Times ranking or whatever, the Shanghai ranking, are so dominated by a paradigm that I would call look like U of T. And so the one size fits all is that the perceived value of universities is about awards, scholarships, citations, research, and including the recruitment of students. And it's very, very hard to carve out a unique value proposition for your institution that sticks, because that value proposition has got to be believed in by the faculty as well. And therefore, when it comes to workloads, or however you measure it, always has a very large component for scholarship and a decreasing component for teaching and time with students. I think that's it's the one size fits all, I think, is one of the biggest difficulties, and government falls into it as much as the universities fall into it.
And you're also seeing that, I guess, in the college sector, too, where the blurring between universities and colleges has happened, especially over the past 30 years.
People understandably want to be there to improve the brand of the institution, to improve its reputation. But who defines the reputation? You don't define the reputation. The community around you, your peers define it. The environment defines it. And so it's very hard for you to say, well, don't believe that reputation, I have a better one for you. And so the colleges saw that the reputation was enhanced by degrees, by research, by applied research, and they had as much concern and motivation to improve their brand as any university. You could call it drift, or you could call it strategic positioning. But it's the one size fits all, or the one paradigm of excellence.
And as you say, everyone wants to be, the top. Everyone wants to move towards a research, intensive university here in Ontario that, is as close to U of T as you possibly could be, I guess. It's that view of global excellence.
Your faculty members want to be invited to the conference. Your faculty members want to... You want to attract the faculty members, the best faculty members, defined by what? Defined by research council funding? What? How does it define? And when you want to give an award, a Polanyi Award, who gets it, right? And you say, well, we have awards, teaching awards within the institution. Yeah, and how many people know about them? Are they in the Toronto Star? But why I'm trying to explain this is not about bad people or bad leaders. It's about the values that society professes as the absolutes, and the motivation of a president to do their very best for the institution, and their very best is improving the reputation and brand of that institution, attracting the best students, attracting the best faculty. And if you follow that line, you follow the research, the citations, etc.
Now, you've got a unique view from the system because you were deputy minister, then you were special advisor at the federal government. You've been, in many different institutions. Maybe you could actually do a little bit of a high level sort of diagnosis of the landscape today that you see it and the challenges.
The challenges for the institution, for the president. I would say I was the last generation of presidents that really was pre-social media. Didn't mean social media didn't exist, but I was never under the microscope of social media like the existing presidents and vice presidents are. And therefore, I think regardless of how difficult my job might have been, I think the jobs of presidents and leaders today is much more difficult than today than they were in my generation. In my generation, you could try to navigate through difficult things a bit without people seeing how all the different cards are being moved and how you are trying to play a hand to be able to best advance the institution. And as you played that hand, you would make mistakes and you would recover and you would try a different approach. But today, everything is open, everything is visible, and therefore the ability to try something new and fail and try again is extremely hard, because it's not only social media, it's media generally loves to be able to highlight the mistakes. What I saw in government, what I saw in universities is that the only way you're not going to make a mistake is do nothing new. Because almost by definition, the moment you try to do something new, there isn't a formula for it. You're inventing the new and you're going to make mistakes. But we don't allow universities to make any mistakes. And as a result, they become, and government too, so risk averse beyond anything imaginable, because they're not allowed to make any errors. And I think that's probably, for government and universities and colleges, the biggest problem we have. We should applaud a university or a college by saying, boy, they really tried this. They got it 70% right. Holy mackerel, the other 30% they're going to improve upon. I've never heard anyone say anything like that. What they jump on is the 30%. And everyone with a rear view mirror is smarter than the president, that they should have seen that 30%, or smarter than the minister, smarter than the deputy minister. So I think that's extremely hard. And the other thing that seems to be changing, and I don't know if I'm just sensitive to it, whether it's more Ontario than other provinces, but a sense that government is no longer looking to post-secondary to solve the human resources problems and the jobs and the changing nature of jobs that once were the fundamental and basic responsibility a post-secondary. So you see very large amounts of money becoming available for training or for retraining. And you look at the words and they almost are purposely omitting public institutions. And why is that? How did this happen? And clearly, governments, whether they're freezing fees, freezing grants, and seeing the challenges the institutions have, they're certainly not running towards them with a bucket of money. And so I like to give an example of this, Daniel. In my recollection, the largest deficit I had to deal with in my 10 years at Ryerson, my recollection, was $8 million. I'm seeing institutions half the size with $30 or $40 million. Their problems are orders of magnitude larger than the ones I had fiscally. And how are they going to deal with these things? How do you creatively deal with these things? How can you possibly say to your faculty, we're going to have to take $5 million to invest in a new product. Well, you're cutting $20 million from the institutions. Could you imagine saying, well, we got to take $30 million, not 20, because we need $10 million for something new? And you go back to who defines the product? It's the faculty. All right, what are you saying to them? Could we eliminate you so that we could? Could you agree to eliminate your job so I could have the money to do something new? The complexities of these jobs are enormous. And then you think, well, why don't they get a president from company XYZ who knows all this? And I say, well, tell me how they're going to be hired. Look at the hiring processes. So all of this goes into the challenges of post-secondary institutions. And I do believe that they're greater than in my generation.
Completely agree with you about all the challenges they're facing. But and as we discussed the other day, you know, government, you know, took away the one tool that some institutions were using to be profitable and to actually achieve a little bit of margins. And without that, a lot of smaller institutions, colleges and universities, and even some of the larger ones are going to be struggling. And that's the international student situation. Do you want to maybe share your views on that and what happened and what should happen?
Yeah, and I've seen this from every angle, an angle of being at the university that looked at it as an opportunity. I was at the federal government that saw what was going on. I was at a private university that benefited from it. So I've seen it from every angle. But if I could give a bit of a, the way I like to describe it, Daniel, is like a bit of a skit. Okay. So I'm the president of University XYZ or College XYZ. And the vice president knocks on my door and says, President, I need $50 for a for sale sign. I say, for sale sign? What? He says, well, we have no more, our tuition is frozen. In fact, it was reduced by 10%. We have no more government grants. We don't have mandatory retirement. We have legitimate union demands for inflation, etc. The cost of operating are going up by CPI. We don't have the money, and we can't continue to cut. Give me the money for the for sale sign, right? And the president is worried, and then someone else knocks on the door and says, I have an idea. Why don't we recruit 500 international students and we will take the profit from those international students and we will fund those things that aren't being funded by domestic fees or by government grants? President says, well, boy, I sure like that. That is an option. But year two comes. You've now got 500 students, and that's in your base budget. The same recurs. What are we going to do next year? What are we going to do next year? Well, we'll go from 500 to 1,000. The next year, 1,000 to 1,500. And then how many international students do you have after 8 or 9 years? And what was the reason for those international students? Was it that you needed their tuition to give them a great experience, blah, all those things? Or was it truthfully you needed that money to be able to pay the normal inflation that was not being covered in the normal way? And you could say you could cut your way to that too. But I don't know any university that was going to say, I'd rather have budget cuts than take on international students. I think this is heroic, but very few would do it. And then you turn around and you look 5, 7 years, and you all of a sudden have new problems that be created by the numbers of international students, whether they are that I didn't build the residence, whether they're housing or whatever. And the federal government, who had the responsibility for bringing students in, wakes up one day and says, holy mackerel, there's a million international students. Almost all of them or a very large want a postgraduate work permit, but we have already a limit on how many work permits we have, and we got a big, big problem. And then what happens is, again, the one-size-fits-all solution, let's just hack it away, right? And now all of the years that the institutions have been patching the lost inflation are coming home to roost. And so why are the cuts so large is that they are accumulative of multiple years that were being papered over by international students. And then you say, well, who's to fault? And my answer is everyone. Don't tell me that governments, federally, provincially, institutions, colleges weren't to fault. And then it gets even worse. Because many institutions finally say, this is working so well. I finally could afford that new building that I need so much, right? So you say, well, that was greed. Well, is it greed? What is that? I didn't see anyone putting the money in their pocket. I saw them trying to improve the brand of their institution and what their institution could deliver.
That's a great description and a great analogy. Really appreciate that, Sheldon. And I was talking to someone the other day as well and saying it's too bad in some ways that the industry groups don't do a better job of actually getting a collective position and discussion on these things. But it is a little bit like the wild, wild west with each institution going their own way. And as you say, everyone being a little bit competitive as well and trying to be the best they can be.
These organizations aren't executive in nature. They're really a meeting place. You know, the expression, trying to herd cats, they're not built that way. They're not, it's not like the California system that is legislative with executive authority and rules. They're voluntary organizations. And whether it's COU or Colleges Ontario, the institutions that are members don't see themselves having common interest. Groups of them might, but collectively, the only common interest is we all need more money, give me higher tuition fees, don't get into my grill on autonomy, but trying to get it at a micro level, good luck. They can't do that.
You've got a unique perspective and unique experience as well. And I know you are an innovative person because I found a quote that I actually loved about you, which is Levy couldn't see the future, but he could help shape it. So how would you shape a sustainable future for these institutions? And say you had a magic wand and some tools, how do you think there are some ways to actually create a better platform for the future?
Well, I'm going to comment two ways. One on the that quote, which I never heard, but it's very really, really makes me smile. I think when people say I accomplished this or I accomplished that with great flattery, I say the following, if I could give another crazy analogy. I knew I wanted to go east. I didn't know that I wanted that the final destination was going to be in Montreal at the coffee shop and I was going to have a latte. I just knew I wanted to go east. But there is an expectation on government boards, etc., that the president can actually navigate to the latte place in Montreal, when in fact, all I knew I was going east. And if I got to Kingston and I got to Kingston and I had to take a trip up to, had to stop at, and had to go off the 401 and make a detour. All of that was trying to take advantage of the opportunities that were there and the new experiences that I had in my travel to finally get to a better location. The idea that people have that you know exactly where you're going and that you can control the future, it's only good on paper. Put it on the shelf, never look at it again. The challenge is to have your community, including the students, sharing that you want to go east, big general ideas, not micro ideas. I used to say I never did a strategic plan because my strategic plan was simply I wanted to be the best at something that mattered to society. And that was going east. So when institutions are under tremendous pressure to be able to answer the question you asked me, and the only guidance I can give them is that you have to be open to the opportunities that are available and navigate with your community to the opportunities that you see. But if government isn't going to step up with funding, and government isn't going to relax on fees, and you continue to have no mandatory retirement, you're going to be boxed in to cutting. And sure you can navigate, but I never had to navigate in an environment of huge negative numbers. I navigated with the biggest number minus eight, but most of them were zero or a small positive. How do you create something new in this environment when you're cutting is extremely, extremely difficult. But I would say the most important thing institutions can do, not the most important, one of the things is to have clarity on the one or two things that will make them better. And don't try to micromanage that definition. Look at the real problems the country is having and ask yourself, can we make a difference in solving one of those problems by the institution who we are? Can we align ourselves to the needs of the society that we have by making the choices that are more in line with what society needs today? And so you can't only point your finger at government. We have to begin to point our finger at ourselves where it's relevant.
Now, maybe we can turn our minds back to actually happier days, I guess, and some of your great successes. And I know one success that you're really well known for is actually, the creation of the Digital Media Zone, or the DMZ, at Ryerson. And at the same time, you were also pushing a sitting building agenda for the university. I think those are probably two of those things that you sort of chose as driving initiatives. But maybe you could talk a little bit about how you did both those things and why they were so important to you.
When I was president, I knew that a couple of blocks down was the U of T, and I was vice president U of T. And I thought it was like one we had a great research university around the corner. I'm not going to be able to compete. I didn't with them on the same terms, and I didn't want to. So that was one thing, a realization of that we had a strength, but it didn't have to be one that tried to duplicate, at least on the same way as the University of Toronto. But really what happened, Daniel, was a few students and a faculty member came to my office and said, look, I'm doing this, and I need, one of the students said, I'm doing this, create this interesting thing. I got a small business, and it was in a digital media space, and I need a place to hang a camera or something like that. Another student came and told me that they wanted to be able to build an exoskeleton and like these ideas that students were having. And then I went to an engineering faculty member's offices, met a PhD student that was doing really interesting things. At that time, it was an app, but no one had an app, but he was building an app. And I thought, oh my God, this is really exciting. Why don't we give the students a place for this? And I then went after, tried to get government money for ages, for a year. No success. Thank God I didn't get it, because I would have had to write a proposal that says you had to go and get the latte at the Starbucks in Montreal, when all I knew was that there was an idea. But I also knew that if it was an idea, you had to show it off. And it couldn't be in the basement of the building as you take the broom closet and make it available. If you were going to do it, then do it boldly. That started DMC, but ultimately it was getting the right people like Val Fox, Sane Ramana, to run it. What you learned was that if you trust students, you're going to win. Just trust them. Yeah, they're going to screw up. They're going to do a lot of things, but get rid of the rules. And that's why it had to be the president, because the president is the only one that could get rid of the rules. The institution just wants to smother people with a reason not to do something. I was accountable for being the rule breaker. And when they were policy rules, I would go to the board. But when they were habits, I'd break the habits. But it was all about students. It was never about anything but helping students be successful. That was the only thing that mattered. And it didn't matter if the student was in engineering or social work. It did not matter. And then trust students. And then make mistakes. Let things develop. It was the cultural change. That was how change was brought. It was getting out of all the rules that stifle you, trusting students, not being prescriptive of the future, letting people define their own future, let people make mistakes. But I did it in an environment that wasn't everyone looking over my shoulder. I did it in an environment where there was, if not adequate funding, we weren't impoverished, right? And so asking institutions to be able to do miracles, I think that's a bit much. But I think institutions have to take a responsibility as well. Government has to reimagine institutions as being parts of solutions. But I don't know what you do about a society that frowns on any mistake anyone makes.
No, it's a huge challenge that the risk aversion that has been put in both governments and our institutions as well. You know, it makes a challenge for leaders as well, and attracting good leaders too. So what advice would you have actually for people who wanted to pursue, you know, leadership in this kind of environment?
Well, despite all of my gloom and doom and everything else, universities and colleges are the best place, are phenomenal institutions. They're wonderful, wonderful places. They're resilient. Times will change. Leaders will find new solutions. I would say to people that making a career in post-secondary education is worthwhile. It's very, very worthwhile. My call to action is really not a call to action of a president or vice president. It's really of all of us to allow people to experiment, allow people to imagine, to fail, to try again, whether they're students or administrators. And it's ironic. Research is all about trying and failing. And in your failure, you build a bit of a road so the next person that takes it can travel a little further. We don't allow that, but we have to allow it as in the evolution of our institutions. And I would say that if we did, the system would become significantly better. Governments would get excited about them again and reinvesting in them. But if we remain paralyzed by the inability to experiment, it's not going to be nice for anyone.
Well said. Now, I wanted to ask you one other question, and that's about you've been at many institutions. So you were at the U of T, and you were at Ryerson, which is now, of course, Toronto Metropolitan University. Do you think it was easier to be innovative and to find solutions in a smaller institution that's, you know, not as established, that had perhaps a different sort of origin story as well?
I don't think it's the size of the institution. That's a very, very good question. U of T is very innovative when I was there. But it's a different type of innovation. I think the challenge isn't large or small. I think the challenge is what I said earlier, which is to understand your institution's uniqueness and how it can contribute to solving a large societal problem, because everyone could be the best at something that matters. And as long as that thing that matters is about the society, the community, the country, however it is, not about that it's the best for me. And a great problem for a small institution in their community is a great problem for their community, whatever it is. But if that's what you want to have your students and your institution known for, and a lot of these is reaching outside of your walls. The city building was simply, I looked around and looked at all around me, and I said, I'm not going to wait for the city to improve it. And I saw what the University of Pennsylvania had done in their community. I learned from others, right? But you have to get beyond feeling that the only thing you do is within the walls. Have your institution see its responsibility bigger than it is. And the other thing, Daniel, what happens, it's just is so exciting, is the moment that you are actually being seen to solving the problems of the society or the community that you have, you go from chasing opportunities to opportunities chasing you. Everything changed when people saw I was a city builder. I thought, holy mackerel, things were coming my way. Well, could you help me here? Could we do this together? Right? Holy mackerel. When Ryerson wanted to be known as the innovation place, everything was coming here. Because people saw you had an ambition that was bigger than I gotta be able to pay the bill today. They saw that you had, and that I think government wants to see that again of institutions. And many institutions do this. But the more you get locked into cutting, it becomes more and more difficult. The more you feel that you can't move because you can't make a mistake, it becomes difficult. It's a very, very hard, very hard. But you got to be allowed to take some risks. You got to be able to allow to dream. And my number one thing for every institution is trust your students. Try to spend more and more time with students. That would be my number one piece of advice.
I love what you're saying about the fact that it's a complex collective entity with, you know, and everyone's got a role to play in it, in success and also the failure as well. But they're also hard to navigate as well and hard to get to know. And I know you talked about when we had a coffee about sort of some role playing that was done by Adil Sedra to have people understand better the context of what they're actually operating in. Do you want maybe describe a little bit about that?
When I was at U of T, Adil was the provost. In fact, he was the model provost for me. But what Adil used to do was that he would have a retreat with chairs, new chairs, every year. And then he would do a bit of a role playing. So he wanted to explain how you deal with, call it a faculty member that thinks they're entitled to a smaller course load and putting pressure on the chair. And what does the chair do when in fact that faculty member is their friend? How does it work? What are the roles? So Adil would have a scenario playing, and all of us would play. I would play the role of the grumpy faculty member, and others would play it. But it was fabulous because it really, at the end of it, you really felt like you were in that role. Most people come into these jobs, a high proportion of them, without experience in that job, right? And that, and especially when you're a chair for the first time or a dean for the first time, even a vice president, sometimes president, this is your first time in that job. Well, how do you know what to expect? So Adel created this school on it, and I thought it worked brilliantly. And he was one of my favorite people of all time.
Is there anything else you want to share? Some final thoughts from your perspective?
The way these conversations naturally go, they go to financial pressures, international students, things aren't working, and all of that. The institutions are critically important for society. And we in the institutions have an enormous responsibility, and we have to look at ourselves and ask, are we doing the best we can? And government has got to trust us more. Ultimately, a society that has weakened post-secondary education will be a weaker society. We can't all point our fingers at someone else. We have to all of us see it as a shared responsibility for the generations yet to come. I just think that these discussions can ultimately get you depressed. But we can't allow that depression to define who we are. There's too much good that could be done and is being done.
That's so well said. I think you're right. Let's try and change this downward spiral sort of thinking and into more of a virtuous circle.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Daniel. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.